Thank you, Madam Chair. Distinguished members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Secretary General of the United Nations, I'd like to welcome you to the 135th session of the Human Rights Committee. And I'd like to start by echoing the congratulations to the members who were re-elected at the 39th meeting of state parties to the covenant, which took place on 17 June earlier this year, this month in New York. So a very warm congratulations to Madam Helen Tigruja and Mr. Hernan Quesada Cabrera. Distinguished members, the 34th annual meeting of the chairpersons of the treaty bodies took place in New York from 30 May to 4 June 2022. The meeting focused on the follow-up to the review of the treaty body system in accordance with General Assembly Resolution 68/268, particularly the recommendations contained in the co-facilitator's report on the process of the consideration of the state of the United Nations Human Rights Treaty System. The chairs agreed to establish a predictable schedule for reviewing state party reports with an 8-year review cycle for full reviews coupled with follow-up reviews in between for the 8 committees that have periodic reviews. And although there are many details of the calendar to work out, it represents a major step forward toward a treaty system in which all state parties will be reviewed on an equal basis, thus giving practical meaning to the UN's aims of universality and non-discrimination. The Committee on Enforced Disappearances, which does not have periodic reviews, reports, will request additional information from state parties every 2, 4, or 8 years, depending on the level of implementation of their convention. And the Subcommittee on Prevention of Torture, which has a mandate to visit countries, to visit state parties, will visit them on average every 8 years with a cyclical dialogue in between visits. So more or less has a periodicity that can be integrated into the calendar. The Human Rights Committee, as you well know, pioneered the predictable 8-year calendar, which is now accepted by the chairpersons of all 10 treaty bodies. This landmark agreement will allow all states parties to all the human rights treaties to prepare for their engagements with the treaty bodies well in advance. It will help rationalize the system for all concerned and provide a basis for a more sustainable allocation of resources, a goal that the Secretary General has stressed in respect of the treaty bodies and other human rights mechanisms in his call to action and in his report, Our Common Agenda. With a formal agreement now reached on this proposal, the office can proceed to flesh out the practical details of such a calendar and cost it to be submitted to the General Assembly this year. It is our hope that this process will yield positive, sustainable results for the treaty body system. I understand that the chair will provide you a comprehensive briefing of the outcome of the chair's meetings in the coming days. Distinguished members, ladies and gentlemen, the Human Rights Council is currently holding its 50th session. I'd like to draw your attention to two panel discussions in particular with special relevance to the work of the Human Rights Committee, both of which will take place tomorrow. The first of these is the panel discussion on the human rights of people in vulnerable situations in the context of climate change. In recent years, the Human Rights Committee has considered the implications of climate change for human rights in relation to individual petitions, reviews of states' parties, and also in its general comment 36 on the right to life issued in 2018, in which it emphasized that environmental degradation, climate change, and unsustainable development constituted some of the most pressing and serious threats to the ability of all of present and future generations to enjoy their right to life. Beyond the right to life, climate change has implications for a number of other rights guaranteed in the covenant as well. For instance, states should ensure access to information, participation in public affairs, and access to justice. The people most vulnerable to the impacts of climate change are often marginalized, including as a result of historic and ongoing structural discrimination and exclusion, who have few other choices. Their meaningful participation at all levels of decision-making and action will empower them as agents of change, prevent discrimination against them, and make climate action more effective. State obligations will also be increasingly invoked by those who cross borders as a result of climate impacts on livelihoods and natural disasters. The views adopted by the Human Rights Committee in 2019, involving a man from Kiribati seeking asylum in New Zealand, constituted the first human rights treaty body decision directly addressing the human rights impact of climate change. And although in the specific case considered by the committee determined that New Zealand had not violated his right to life by deporting him. It noted, however, that the effects of climate change in receiving states may expose individuals to a violation of their rights under Article 6 and 7 of the Covenant, thereby triggering the non-refoulement obligations of sending states. The growing interest in climate change and human rights might well signal that this issue is likely to be increasingly raised before the treaty bodies, including your committee. The second debate that I would like to highlight is the high-level panel discussion on countering the negative impact of disinformation on the enjoyment and realization of human rights. Building on two recent resolutions and a report by the Special Rapporteur on freedom of opinion and expression, this discussion will be the first opportunity for the Human Rights Council to focus on the challenges posed by disinformation. When viewed by those with political, social, and economic grievances, disinformation can undermine trust in public institutions and processes, such as in the case of public health and elections, among others. Widespread disinformation can be particularly harmful in times of public emergency, and it can be utilized by states and state-sponsored actors as a part of influence operations that exploit and undermine liberty in societies and can accompany serious violations of international law. Conversely, states' responses to disinformation have in some cases imposed undue restrictions to freedom of expression and in some instances have been used to undermine the work of human rights defenders and journalists. Council Resolution 49/21 emphasizes that countering disinformation should not be used as a pretext to restrict the enjoyment and realization of human rights or to justify censorship, including through vague and overly broad laws criminalizing disinformation. According to the resolution, countering disinformation from a human rights perspective will require that states refrain from conducting or sponsoring disinformation campaigns, promote access to diverse and reliable information, reaffirm their commitment to media diversity and independence, and ensure the protection of the right to freedom of opinion and expression. So, distinguished members, ladies and gentlemen, turning to your program of work for this session, the committee is due to examine the implementation of the covenant in a number of states' parties and review 49 individual communications under the optional protocol. As usual, you will have numerous meetings with a wide variety of stakeholders, and I'm pleased to see a number of them here in the back of the room, as the chair mentioned. My colleagues and I look forward to supporting your work at this now opening session. And with this, I'd like to extend my best wishes to all of you for a successful and productive session on behalf of the Secretary General. Thank you, Madam.